This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, this is Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Sumitra Selvaraj. This year marks the 30th anniversary of the signing of the Convention of the Rights of the Child, which is the world's most ratified human rights treaty in history. The agreement recognizes that childhood is a time of vulnerability and that children need special care and protection provided by those responsible for their well-being, from parents to communities and from service sectors to governments. For Universal Children's Day, we speak to Seema Sengupta, the Deputy Representative at UNICEF Afghanistan, about the work that is being done to address the psychosocial needs of children living in war and conflict zones. Hello, Seema. Welcome back to BFM. When we spoke to you last in 2015, you were UNICEF's Chief of Child Protection in Somalia.
Correct.
You've since moved on to a different portfolio. Perhaps we can begin with you sharing with us what you've been up to since you were last on BFM.
Thank you, Sumitra. Thanks so much for having me back, actually.
You're most welcome.
So, between Somalia and now, I went to Bangladesh after Somalia, and I was the deputy representative of UNICEF in Bangladesh. Mm-hmm. I was there for about 2.5 years. And the deputy representative is a big term. It sounds like a big name in UNICEF, but actually it is the head of programs. So it really oversees the programs that UNICEF delivers for children in a particular country. Mm-hmm. And now, since February of this year, I'm deputy representative of UNICEF in Afghanistan. So pretty much a similar thing as what I was doing in Bangladesh. Mm-hmm. But of course, the program is different. The country context of Afghanistan is very different from Bangladesh.
How do you know where you're going next? Who makes a decision as to where you're going next?
Each time an international professional in UNICEF moves, mm-hmm. they have to apply. So, you know, each vacancy is advertised. Mm-hmm. And for senior staff, which is where I am, there is a senior staff rotation, which is advertised every year. And based on one's tour of duty, one applies. But the decisions are made by a global management team.
So why did you pick Afghanistan?
I didn't. Well, yeah, I had a choice of 5 countries, and okay. We won't talk about which those 5 were, but one of them was close enough to a context as Afghanistan is. Mm-hmm. And a lot of things are important to look at that UNICEF looks at. You know, it looks at nationalities of the staff that they are sending to that country to make sure that there are no sensitivities around it. Mm-hmm. You know, especially in countries which are in conflict, sometimes certain nationalities may not be the right match for that country and so on. There are those politics and stuff. So I was offered Afghanistan, and I thought about it. It's a non-family duty station, which means you go alone, you go without family. I have a husband and I have a daughter who's in university. We discussed it as a family and we thought, yes, I could do it.
So. Okay. Well, we're going to get back to your current portfolio shortly. But first, among your many career highlights is the work that you've done in developing psychosocial support programs for UNICEF's emergency mm-hmm. response. Now, for our listeners who may not be familiar with this term, what exactly is a psychosocial support program for children? And how is it utilized?
So let me say something. When we hear the word psycho in any word, it sounds like it's really heavy and mental or whatever. But actually, psychosocial support is quite a simple term. It really means the well-being of a person. And well-being means physical and mental well-being. Mm. So psychosocial support programs that UNICEF actually has in place is to address the well-being of a child. Mm. And this does not only happen in conflict-affected countries. It can happen after natural disasters. You look at psychosocial well-being of children who face violence, who can be traumatized because of being trafficked, you know, all kinds of things. So psychosocial support is something which actually helps to bring a child back to normalcy. Mm. As simple as that. But it means that we put programs in place where, first of all, it is to understand, to be able to identify that the child is not in that state of well-being.
Right.
Right? Because a child can look and actually go through the motions of being in a normal state, mm. but the child might actually be traumatized and holding it in, which is even more harmful to the child. Mm. So really, we work with caregivers, we work with teachers, training them, getting them to understand and be able to identify, look for the signs and symptoms of trauma, possibly, or a child who has been whose well-being is a bit imbalanced at a particular point. And once then, to actually establish that rapport. Mm. And sometimes that rapport, that support, the care that is given by that caregiver is enough.
Mm.
But sometimes, 5% of the cases often have to be referred to a more professional psychologist or up the scale, if
right.
you like. Yeah.
Okay. You mentioned signs and symptoms. Now, I read an article on the UNICEF website which mentions that almost 250 million children live in countries affected by violent conflicts,
mm-hmm.
and an estimated 68 million people, half of them children, are displaced by conflict.
Mm-hmm.
I'm about to ask a huge question, and don't worry, we have time for the answer.
Sure.
Could you share with us how children are affected by violent conflict?
So, you know, Sumitra, I've worked in, so the countries where violent conflict, where I've worked in with violent conflict is Sri Lanka at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Now Sri Lanka is much better off than it was when I was there in 2005 to 2008, then Somalia,
yes.
and now Afghanistan. And I think when I worked in Sri Lanka, my title was actually psychosocial specialist. So really what you see is, you know, children are very resilient, right? So you do see children going through the motions, going to school, doing all the normal things if they put in that process. And that is one of the things we try to do, like at least have the appearance of normalcy as soon as possible. But what does happen, and even after natural disasters, mm-hmm. right? Loss of parents, loss of family, loss of home, you know.
Disruption to education.
All of that, you know, and it comes out in different ways. Some children withdraw and you know, become less communicative. Some children jump at sounds and are afraid and don't want to bond. Some children, especially when they've had multiple losses, and this often happens in conflict-affected countries, you lose a grandparent at one point, you lose a brother at another point, you lose someone else. So when they've had multiple disruptions or multiple trauma, then they become less and less communicative. They become very hard on the surface. And those are the ones you worry more about because, you know, when a child becomes very hard, almost sounding like an adult who can manage for himself,
mm-hmm.
then adults tend to leave them alone as well. And that's when you worry because then that child's not going to have anyone to support him. So I think that those are the signs that you see in the beginning. But sometimes longer term trauma can also have an impact. And it also means that it influences the way a child interacts with other children, mm-hmm. other adults, other siblings, especially when children become heads of families because of loss of the adults, right? So the older sibling might suddenly become the head of the family, even at the age of 11. And then they don't have the time to grieve. They don't have the time to be children, and they become harder with their siblings. They become protective, but they become harder and actually don't have much time for themselves.
Well, they have to grow up.
They have to grow up, but yeah. bottling up all that trauma and bottling up all that feeling inside, which, you know, I mean, is in the longer term, it changes the person that could have been. And you really have no idea what's going to come out of that, right?
Mm. So how do you actually go about assessing their needs then, mm-hmm. psychosocial mm-hmm. needs of a vulnerable mm-hmm. child? How would you even begin this process?
So what we have, and you know, it is quite structured in the beginning. And when I say beginning, it is, say, 1999, 2000, you know, natural disasters, earthquakes and so on when mm-hmm. they happen. We didn't really know very well how to do this, right? Because mm. we were used to do one-on-one assessments.
Mm.
And that's different from mass assessments that are required.
Right.
But now it's quite structured. We have learned from all these various experiences. And we do have tools in place. And often some of them are play tools that you can actually administer to a group of children. And teachers or whoever the animators are, they can pick out the ones who don't do what is normally done, say with dolls or so on, you know. So different tools which are sometimes in the form of play, different material, classroom behavior. So that it's quite, there are guidelines and quite structured guidance on how to go about this as well.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier on that some children perhaps require more specialized
mm-hmm.
care,
mm-hmm.
Especially if they perhaps come to you with pre-existing health
mm-hmm.
issues.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of help can be extended to these children?
So I'm thinking of a child in Myanmar, and I think it'll make it easier for your audience. I think, so when I was in Myanmar, this was after the Nargis, and we had psychosocial support through child-friendly spaces established in various parts, and, you know, over 2,000 kids were going to these in certain places and so on. One of the places that I went to at that point had this child, and they came to me and they said, you know, we really need help with this child. This has been going on for, you know, 6 months. And usually 6 months of continuous support through a child-friendly space is enough to bring a child back towards normalcy. And they said, but this child, we just can't, he comes every day. And he was about, you know, 10 or 11. He comes every day, but he does not, in all the time he's been here, he does not speak to anyone, not to the teacher, not to the friends, nothing. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we said, okay, let's see, who does he live with? Who's at home and so on? He lived with his grandmother because he had lost everybody else, lost his parents, siblings disappeared, and lost his closest friend. So, you know, the thing was that we said, okay, let him come. The fact that he is coming to the child-friendly space means he's definitely getting something. Don't lose interest in him. Keep talking to him. It may sound like he's not listening to you. It may sound like he's not interested, but do talk to him. Do draw him out. And, you know, at one point with that constant attention push and getting the grandmother to participate and telling the grandmother what to do at home and so on, the child did slowly begin. And one day I remember going back and they said the dam had burst.
Wow.
You know, he just... over a little game with another child, the kids were playing. He wasn't, but he would always stand there. He wouldn't retreat. He would just observe. And they were playing a game, which was one of the, you know, it's a very traditional game. And he didn't like the way someone was playing it and suddenly had an outburst. And then that just, like I said, the dam burst, because everything just came out and he was shouting, screaming, hitting, crying. And then when they got him to calm down, sit him down, and then over a period of time. So what triggered it was that was something he and his close friend used to play, right? And these other kids were not playing it the right way, and he couldn't stand it anymore. And his close friend was closer to him than his siblings. So it really got to him. And that kind of opened the way up for then other counselors talking to him and finding, you know, what had he bottled up, taking him through, you know, a few months of counseling one-on-one, and then seeing, okay, does he need help or not? And then they referred him to a psychologist just to see that that one-on-one assessment is done. It's all clear. And I think it took him about a year to finally come out with an all clear.
I'm really glad you used this example, because you also mentioned this little boy's grandmother. Mm-hmm. I've got some questions for you about caregivers of children living in conflict, but we're going to be taking a short break first. I'm speaking to Seema Sengupta, the Deputy Representative at UNICEF Afghanistan. You're listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Sumitra Salvaraj. I'm speaking to Seema Sengupta, the Deputy Representative at UNICEF Afghanistan. And before the break, Seema explained a little about how children living in war and conflict zones are affected by the adverse situation that they're in. I'd now like to ask if UNICEF also looks into the needs of caregivers of these vulnerable children.
Yes, we do. One of the things we have learned is it is so important to work with the caregivers, because caregivers also need their needs to be attended to, because if they don't return to normalcy, they can't really care for the others. So we do in various countries around the world where we have psychosocial programs, we do have programs for caregivers as well, where we have a similar kind of, you know, what we find in such circumstances is group activities and group sessions do really help, getting them to come together and share their experiences, and one supporting the other, peer support. Those kind of things really help with caregivers as well.
Okay. And then the next step, you know, as these vulnerable children then grow into adulthood, there is the possibility that they may carry the trauma of their disrupted childhood. What sort of measures need to be put into place to ensure that sustained support is available to this individual throughout their lifetime.
So when we were in Sri Lanka, one of the things we did was, UNICEF did with the government of Sri Lanka, was to roll out a psychosocial program through all the 2,000 schools in the island. So it was an island-wide program. The reason was for that was, while we started at the community level, you know, after the tsunami and because of the war, so at the community level, there was some psychosocial support. But the aim was to get the kids all back in school. Mm-hmm. And Sri Lanka is a country with high school enrollment rates. Mm. So the idea was, if kids are going to stay in school, the teachers are going to be the next most important people in their lives after their family, right? So we rolled out modules of training for teachers, which were then kind of incorporated into the teacher training curriculum. So it became a sustainable thing. It became something which all teachers then in subsequent years would be trained on, how to identify, what to do, what the referrals are, and so on, right? And then this went, because it was island-wide, that means all children in school throughout the island would have trained teachers, teachers trained in psychosocial support. We also worked with the government of Sri Lanka to ensure that there were two psychosocial counselors in every school. So this is something that then takes the child through that whole school life, which if you look at it, you know, depending on where the child is when the trauma happens, it actually takes through takes them through till the age of 18. Now, by that time, you would hope that it is addressed. But during that time, they would have also identified, you know, it's usually, if you look at the, there's a psychosocial prism that we talk about, a triangle, if you like, and the top 5% only actually need more professional psychiatric or psychologist's help. And so during that time, those 5% should have been identified and moved on. And then they go in through the adult process. So the referral services that we put in place, the referral pathways, actually help take that child from childhood to adolescence to adulthood. And it goes in place. So that is why working on a system-wide approach for psychosocial support is extremely important. And that is what we try to do.
So with this example of Sri Lanka that you just gave, right, it's so clear that you definitely tweak and customize psychosocial programs from country to country. What are the aspects that need to be looked into before the customization can happen?
Right. So, you know, I think one of the things is, and you're very, very right, it's the context is so important, right? Now, in a country like Sri Lanka, we could look at a system-wide approach because you had schools already in place. You had, you have institutions, you had the ministry, the social services, all of that, right?
And as you mentioned, high enrollment.
Exactly. Yes. So, you know, that could be taken care of. And so we did an island-wide school approach. Now, when I was in Somalia, that wasn't the case. You know, you didn't have all kids in schools. You didn't have a strong system in place yet at that time. So we had to think of community approaches. We had to think of looking at NGOs who would be there, because it also meant in a country like Somalia, there would be periods of time when we as UNICEF would not have access, but there would be local community support groups who would always be in the community. So then there, what we did is we transferred those skills, worked very closely with the local community groups. In Afghanistan, where I am now, we have something called child protection networks. Right. So we call them the CPAN. The child protection networks are actually a network of community members who are in the community, the community elders, nurses, doctors, whatever, in a community, in a village, who are always there. Right. So what we do is the same sort of training, the same sort of guidance and coaching and all of that is provided to them so that they are able to provide that. And they are there. They're going to be there throughout the life of that child, adolescent, moving on to adulthood. So we look at, as you say, we tweak it. We look at what is most relevant for that particular context.
Okay. Glad, again, you mentioned Afghanistan, because that is your current designation. You're Deputy Representative of UNICEF in Afghanistan. I'd like to get your thoughts on children there who are affected by gender and sexual-based violence. I found a troubling study by Save the Children Afghanistan back from 2017 said 91% of children surveyed out of 1,000 reported some form of abuse. That's about 900 over children. 900 children too many, if you ask me. In your experience since holding this portfolio since February of this year, what is the reality of life like for Afghani children?
So Afghan children are really, I think, one of the most disadvantaged children. Don't forget, Afghanistan has been in a situation of conflict for 40 years, mm-hmm. which means you have two generations of kids who've actually known only conflict and nothing else. Mm. When I was in Somalia, it was 20 years. When I was in Sri Lanka, it was 20 years. But this one is 40, right? Which means that when you have two generations of kids who've seen nothing but conflict, it also changes who they are, right?
Yes.
Because you and I, luckily and thankfully, have had peace and stability to guide. You know, that's how we were brought up. Our parents brought us up in that way. Our school, our communities were that. Mm. But for them, they see violence everywhere. They look, they see conflict, violence, guns, death. That's what they see. That's what they've grown up with. So you remember I was saying it hardens people, right? That's what's happening to them. They're getting, you know, they are resilient. Of course, they get up and they do what they have to do. And I think the long-term impact is that, you know, they, I look at them and I sometimes, I was just saying to a couple of people today, I remember when we were, you know, recently, very recently, we were driving out into the city and there's this old kind of gun mounted on something, a very old one. But it's a gun nevertheless, you know, and I saw these kids who were going to school, little boys, 9, 10 years old, stop on the way and jump on the gun and, you know, and I look at it and I go, you know, and then the driver next to me says, oh, don't worry, it's not loaded, it's fine, nothing. I said, I know, but, you know.
It's a gun.
It's a gun. And I said, you know, where I come from, children would have run away from that. And these kids are actually embracing it, climbing on it like it's a seesaw or a slide or something like that, you know. And so you see how different it is. Mm. I mean, they start looking at it as though that is normal. And, you know, we talked about psychosocial support, bringing children back to normalcy. But what is normal?
It is their normal.
It is their normal. So it is within that context to actually be able to show them and have them believe that there is something that is more normal. There is something, there is a possibility of a world where there are no guns, where you are safe, where there is no violence. And getting communities to say, you know, so everything is relative. So that is why violence against children is very high in a country like Afghanistan, mm-hmm. because, you know, communities are used to seeing severe violence in terms of guns and killing and landmines and so on. And so one slap on the face is like,
it's nothing.
It's nothing. So everything is relative, right? But for that child, it is a slap on the face. It is many slaps. It is being beaten. It is violence, right? Mm. So it is, it's not an easy place to be, you know?
You mentioned that there is a very high incidence of violence against children. Are boy children affected as much as girl children, or how are they affected differently?
So I think, well, when you look at children as children, I think they're all affected similarly. But at the same time, we have data that shows us that adolescent girls and women actually face a very high level of violence. Mm. So there is domestic violence as well, because the status of women is not where it should be. Mm. Women are not considered equal. Women are considered as a lot to be protected by their male family members, mm. And to be protected in any way. And that could itself bring about a lot of violence because they're not empowered enough, or there is no desire to empower them to stand up for themselves. To a large extent, it is changing. I know, I mean, we look at cities, we look at the government of Afghanistan is really pushing for more girls in school, girls' education. Mm-hmm. For UNICEF in Afghanistan, it's a big priority. We'd like to see all girls in school. In Afghanistan, currently, there are 3.5 million children out of school, out of which 60% are girls. So there is a lot of push yet from everyone to see more girls come to school, stay in school. You know, if girls stay in school, child marriage can be pushed back. Mm-hmm. Girls will get married later. It has that whole thing, you know, the dividends on their health and well-being is great. So there is a lot of push for that. We can see that. But it's going to take time because it's about changing communities, changing social norms. It's also the fear. I mean, there are families, I've talked to mothers who would like to see their girls go to school every day, but they're afraid. And they say, can you ensure that they'll be safe? Can you ensure that they'll come back? And who can? You know, I think that's the worry. Schools are, last year we had more than 1,000 schools in Afghanistan which were closed because of various attacks, which may not be direct attacks on the school. It's collateral damage, it's elections, it's so on and so forth. But parents get afraid. And once the school is closed, once there is an attack, once the school is impacted by a bomb or something, they're afraid to send the kids to school again. And they're more afraid for their girls and the boys, you know, because, again, they feel they need to protect the girls more.
Sure.
So then they get left at home, you know.
You mentioned child marriage. I'm sure that tackling child marriage in a country like Afghanistan entails treading very, very carefully around cultural sensitivities. How does UNICEF navigate this treacherous ground while putting the rights of the child firmly in the foreground?
Good question. You know, because very, very important to tackle child marriage is looking at what the drivers are, right? And when I was in Bangladesh, it was also a priority program in Bangladesh. But the drivers of child marriage there are different from the drivers of child marriage in Afghanistan.
Could you explain the difference?
Sure. So, for instance, in Bangladesh, it was poverty, right? A huge thing was poverty because parents felt that they couldn't feed one more girl for longer. They couldn't send her to school for longer. Mm-hmm. If you got your daughter married off younger, you paid a lower dowry. You know, so there's all of that. In Afghanistan, it is about keeping your honor intact.
Mm-hmm.
It is about the war. It is about, I should get her married off and she should become, you know, she should have a life and be safe. Someone else will take care of her. Aging parents.
Mm-hmm.
So it's safety and security. So the drivers are different. At the same time, there is, you know, don't forget, in Afghanistan, we've had Taliban not too far ago, you know, not too long ago when they were in control and they didn't want children, girls going to school. So again, parents felt that, okay, the safety is in the protector. Getting her married to a man who can keep her safe is what they need to do. So very different drivers. So working with the communities, working with parents is very important. And then to say, well, you need to send her to school. Well, sending her to school will mean that she will make, she will go from school to university. She will have a life. There is a bit of empowerment. There is this and that. It is, and then also looking at it from the health aspect, talking to them about the health of your daughter, you know, because as if she has a teenage pregnancy, even if it's after marriage, which it is, what does it mean for her? Giving them the figures that they're faced with, you know, child deaths and maternal deaths, and say this is the cause of it. But, you know, if you give her a few more years, the chance of survival for the child and for herself is much higher. So it's a multifaceted approach that we have to use, a multi-pronged approach of health, social norms, education, bringing all of that to bear. But of course, you know, when they say, but can you guarantee the safety of my child?
Yes.
We can't. And it is for us to work with the government to do so. One of the things we do in Afghanistan is we support over 5,000 community-based classrooms.
Okay.
So the idea is if the girl can't go to school, we bring the classroom to her.
Mm-hmm.
So in communities where, you know, it's a trek to the school or parents are really afraid because of, you know, increased conflict and so on and fighting, we work with the community and say, you've got courtyard space, you've got an extra room. Can we run a school here? Can we run a classroom? Can we run two classrooms so the girls can come here? We provide you with the teachers. We provide with the materials. We'll train the teacher. Will you give your space? And we've seen that has happened. You know, that has really helped because having more than 5,000 of these means in all those places, the girls can go to school. Boys do too, but we have more girls attending these, of course.
Okay. I'd like to move on now to the 30th anniversary of the signing of the Convention on the Rights of the Child, since we've been talking about child rights. It is, of course, the world's most ratified human rights treaty.
Absolutely.
But the global statistics on the violation of child rights would cause you to think otherwise. Perhaps you can first help us understand, Shima, how do countries become a part of the convention first? And then What are their subsequent obligations?
Sure. I think, you know, when you look at it, it's interesting. I mean, my history is interesting. I worked in Ghana, which was the first country to ratify it.
Okay.
And so let's look at Ghana. And they were very proud of this. You know, I didn't know they were the first country until I went there and they told me this. And Ghana had another thing that they would always tell me, which I really found very, very amusing, but humbling, is when I arrived in Ghana, they said to me, you're from Malaysia. You know, our year of independence is the same as yours.
Exactly.
And look at where you are and look at where we were. So I was very humbled, but very proud and thankful to be Malaysian and to have gone through all the things that I did. I mean, to have everything that I did growing up compared to, you know, the state there. But what really was good and gratifying was the commitment of the government to take that forward. They would tell us they wanted to do this and they wanted to get better and they wanted to do that. So that's a country that actually did it, was the first, was very proud of being the first one to ratify it, and then had all these laws, but the implementation wasn't there because child budgeting is very important. Mm. And so the people who are the policymakers and the legislators, they do it. But then who put, you know, there's a big gap between the budget people and the actual policymakers.
Absolutely.
So that's where your implementation drops off.
Mm.
Then I went to Somalia and everyone was saying, wow, you're going to go from the first country to the country that hasn't ratified it. And when I arrived there, one of the things the representative said to me is, out of the three things, one is you need to get the ratification of the CRC, because I was chief of child protection and in UNICEF. It shouldn't be. I think it's everybody's responsibility, but somehow it sits with child protection. And we did. My team did. We were the team that actually got it ratified in 2015. Somalia ratified the CRC. And actually, later, we were using that to argue when we wanted children who were associated with armed groups to be released to us, we were quoting the CRC ratification. We said, you ratified it. And according to that, children should be treated in specific ways. And you need to find that and not put them in detention and throw the keys away. You know, this is what you need to do. And then in Afghanistan, they ratified it many years ago. We have a lot of legislation in place. So what we find, and you know, it can be used in different ways in different countries.
Mm.
I think in countries like Ghana, Somalia, and Afghanistan, just because I'm giving you those as examples, is we often remind the government of its obligation. We remind them. UNICEF's role is often to say, this is where the gap is. You know, you've ratified, you've committed, but this is where the gap is. We need a legislation to take this forward. So the first step is the policy, the legislation. But of course, then there is also the budgeting that needs to happen.
Mm.
And I think if you look at some of the gaps, you will see that many countries have gone very quickly, ratified, have framed legislation and all of that. And then the implementation just drops off. That is why it's so poor. Because we didn't always see that we needed to do that budgeting side as well.
Mm.
Child budgeting, again, has become a big thing for UNICEF now. In many countries, we take this forward and we really advocate for budgeting for children, you know, providing the government, supporting them to get the evidence and the data so that they're able to advocate. The line ministries are able to advocate with the finance ministry to actually put their money where their mouth is, right? And I think that's a huge thing that needs to happen, is beginning to happen, but of course it's not up there for all the countries.
Okay. You've served in 7 countries so far, 7 and counting, I shall say. In your view, in the countries that you've served in, has UNICEF done all that it can do to ensure that the convention is acceded to?
You know, that's a tough question because in UNICEF, we often say sometimes we need to be reminded that we cannot and should not be doing all. Because our job is actually to work with the government, to support it, to meet its obligation.
Mm.
The Convention on the Rights of the Child is clear. The obligation is with the state party.
But you are the only entity that's named in the convention.
Exactly. So we often forget and we take the convention as our own and start doing the things. So I think we do our best. We try to put the resources when we have, we raise the resources, but more than the resources, more than the financial resources, I must say, it is also the technical resources and the advocacy. I think a big role for us is to remind the government, you ratified this. This means that. Mm. This means you are obliged to provide. You know, I think that reminder is something that we keep bringing to the fore. And it's very important to do so. It's not something you sign and you keep in your back pocket and you've forgotten, or it's gathering dust on a shelf. Don't forget, old countries actually are obligated to report as well. Mm-hmm. And UNICEF plays a role in that. We support the government in its reporting processes. The NGOs work on an alternative mm-hmm. report. And you know, reminding them, taking them through that. When we do our planning in any country, we look at the recommendations from the last CRC report. So, you know, there is a whole process with that. But yes, could we do better? Could we do more? Yes, of course. We can always do more.
And speaking of more, how would you like to see the convention strengthened? Let's look at it on a macro level, mm-hmm. and then let's look at it from your personal portfolio at the moment of Afghanistan.
Sure. I think, you know, when you look at the convention and where it has gone in 30 years, the convention also has three optional protocols, right? So one optional protocol is about children and armed conflict. And that had to come through because of all the armed conflict that we have now. Mm. The other one is on pornography and child trafficking. Again, a huge thing because of the trafficking that's happened.
Yep.
The third one, which is most relevant to countries like Malaysia as well, is about communication and online safety and so on. Mm. So I think in a way we are, the convention has been good at kind of, I shouldn't say we, at looking at the things, the issues that are coming up and actually coming up with these options. But the term optional protocol, optional, you know, already makes it, you know, already takes away from it,
yeah.
right? When we were getting it ratified in Somalia, we said, you know, you're doing it at a time when these protocols have come. So why don't you do all of it? And they're like, no, not relevant for us. It's optional. And then you realize that, okay, let's get the main one and so on. So I think, and then strengthening that accountability, because they report and they come back and yeah. there's recommendation, but there's nothing to hold them to it.
Yes.
That is so, so important.
Yes.
When we look at Afghanistan, a country like Afghanistan, yes, they ratified it long, long ago. It's a forgotten one. How do you, again, what can we do, or what can we use to hold a government that has a war going on, that has poverty, at such high levels of poverty, such high levels of unemployment? How do we hold such a government accountable to its obligation on the Convention on the Rights of the Child? You know, it's one of the conventions that, like you say, it's the most ratified, mm-hmm. but it's also kind of often looked at as the least important. It's children or those little people, mm-hmm. you know. And I think that's where we try to. So what we are doing in Afghanistan is constantly reminding every time a child is killed because of some attack somewhere, even if it's collateral damage mm-hmm. or a school, or they use a medical facility or a school for elections, we remind them. It's, you know, it's about reminding them that this is your obligation. But like I say, it is, if you look at the many priorities they have, how do we get them to actually put the money for the child rights agenda over peace?
I think that's an excellent question for governments around the world.
Right.
You know, you've been doing this work for nearly two decades.
Gosh, don't say it like that. I sound like terribly old.
When we interviewed you back in 2015, you said that when you were studying psychology, a career in UNICEF was not even in your sights.
Yeah.
I'm
Malaysian. I've never heard of UNICEF at that point.
Now I ask you, would you be able to move from this work to a different field?
Are you asking me whether I would leave UNICEF?
Yes.
Are you offering me a job? I don't know. I mean, there are days, or there are times, or a lot of times when I will say, I'm just going to do it for a bit more. And, you know, when I leave UNICEF or when I move on.
Mm.
But it's all out there, because, the thing is, I think that the other side of the coin is, what keeps me in UNICEF, right? Mm. And it really is the kids. You know, I do spend a lot of time in the field, even though I'm deputy representative, which is like a management position. I do go out to the field, even in Afghanistan. I will go up in the mountains and down by the lake and, you know, wherever, in the most remotest corners, because I do want to go and talk to the women and understand how, what they see for their children and what they need. And I do spend time with the kids, even if they cry or whatever, or adolescents, listening to them. And each time I do that, that gives me, you know, that gives my life in UNICEF another, it's like another lifeline in UNICEF, because then I'm like all motivated and I want to stay and I can see the difference we make.
Shima, all the very best in your work with UNICEF, and thank you for flying the Malaysian flag high. But most of all, thank you for always putting the rights of children squarely first.
Thank you. And thank you for actually giving me an opportunity to talk about the work of UNICEF, but really to talk about the plight of children, especially in CRC at 30.
I've been speaking to Shima Sengupta, the Deputy Representative at UNICEF Afghanistan, about children who live in conflict zones and the work that is being done to support their psychosocial development. If you missed any part of this interview or any previous Live and Learn segments, you can download the podcasts on our BFM app or on Spotify. You've been listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.